From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Almost exactly 50 years ago, the actor and entertainer Judy Garland was about to give the performance of her life. It was April 23rd in Carnegie Hall in New York City. Curtain time was 8:30, but 8:30 came and went. It was 8:45, 8:50. Judy Garland hadn't appeared on stage. It's exactly what people had worried about. She had a reputation for being unreliable. Alcohol and pills had broken her body down. Her career had flatlined, but this was supposed to be her comeback. Her conductor, Mort Lindsay, could see Judy standing in the wings. Turns out she was just savoring the moment. Lindsay said, "Finally, she gives me the nod, and I start the overture." Today in the program, we're talking about a memorable concert from a memorable woman. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about one particular evening 50 years ago, nearly exactly 50 years ago today, Judy Garland gave the concert of her lifetime at Carnegie Hall in New York City. We got the idea for the show from an article in the most recent edition of Vanity Fair written by the journalist and biographer James Kaplan. Kaplan says the concert that night has been called the greatest evening in show business history. It's an exaggeration, he says, but a forgivable one. For Garland, the stakes couldn't have been higher. She wasn't yet 40 years old, but addiction and depression had broken down her body and mind. Most everyone figured her career was over. So when she stepped out into the lights that night, people were dying to see what would happen. We're talking about that concert today in the program. James Kaplan is taking us through the night, and of course we'll play some moments from that evening. James Kaplan is a journalist, a novelist, as I said, a biographer. His most recent book is called Frank, The Voice. It's the first in a two-volume biography of Frank Sinatra. Kaplan's reviews and essays have appeared in The New Yorker, Esquire, among others. His article, Over the Rainbow and Then Some, appears in the May issue of the magazine Vanity Fair. And James Kaplan is joining us today from the Radio Foundation in New York City. And James Kaplan, welcome. Thank you very much for doing this.
Oh, thank you so much, Doug. I'm delighted to be here.
So we're going to spend the hour kind of breaking down, exploring this evening, but help, if you would, first give us a brief overview. Tell us what you yourself found so remarkable about this moment.
Well, this was a moment when Judy Garland had really come back to life. About a year and a half before this concert, she had been told that she could never perform again. She had been so sick. She had been very close to death, hospitalized with liver failure. Her doctors said that she needed complete bed rest. Her reaction to this was whoopee. She had been in harness since she was 4 years old when she joined her sister's vaudeville act, the Gum Sisters, and then went to work for MGM. And made it through 15 years at MGM on a combination of sheer willpower and amphetamines and drugs to barbiturates to help her to get to sleep at night. Although after a while, sleep stopped coming. MGM dropped her; they let her go in 1950 because she had ceased to become dependable. The drugs that they depended on her for had made her undependable. She couldn't show up on a movie set dependably anymore. And so they cut her loose. She sang concerts throughout the 50s, very often in very bad shape, culminating in 1959, 60, when she was so sick that she had to be hospitalized. And so she, under new management and trying her best to be clean, she began a series of concerts in 1961. And the culmination of it, not the end of it, but the culmination of it was this Carnegie Hall, this great, great concert.
It seems the idea was to rehabilitate, to kind of revive her career. And I guess the turning point was finding Freddie Fields, an ambitious executive at the record company MCA. And you say that he's kind of itching to get out on his own and find, but he needs a vehicle for this. And he finds Judy Garland, and he puts together what you call this grand plan for her to revive her career.
Yes, records, clubs, and a concert tour. And Freddie Fields, was an agent at MCA. He decided to go out on his own, start his own agency. He wanted to have a boutique agency consisting just of about a dozen superstars. But the problem was that at the beginning, he didn't have any superstars. He had his wife, Polly Bergen. He had Phil Silvers. They were stars. They weren't grand stars. And so he set his sights on Judy Garland because he knew that Judy Garland was gettable. She was down on her luck. She had a lot of trouble. And he figured if he could get her clean, get her on the road, get her working hard, working really, really hard, then he could turn her around and they could make a lot of money together. Later on, less good things happened with Freddie Fields and his assistant, a man named David Beagleman, but that's another part of the story.
Yeah, it is. But you know what's so great about the piece, I have to say, is it's just you distill it into this one moment. I mean, you talk a little bit about how it happened and why it happened, but what's so lovely about it, and it seems the thing that interested you was kind of the buildup to this extraordinary moment.
Well, it's an extraordinary moment in history. You know, it's early 1961. JFK has just been elected. He has just taken office in January. First few months of his administration, I was alive then. Everybody was very hopeful. It was the new frontier. It was the decision to shoot for the moon and the formation of the Peace Corps. It was all bright hope then. And I think that Judy Garland's rehabilitation was part of that picture.
So step one in the grand plan, of course, is this tour. And so she did these concerts around the country, as you said. The question is, I guess, what made Carnegie so special? Because as you say, driving audiences crazy in Dallas and Houston is one thing. Yeah. Carnegie Hall is something else again.
Yes. Carnegie Hall was, as Polly Bergen told me, and she was married to Freddie Fields at the time. Polly Bergen was not. She has very severely mixed feelings to this day about Judy Garland. Artistically, she revered Judy Garland. And Polly Bergen, lest we not forget, still on Desperate Housewives. She was a significant singer, actress in her day. She revered Judy Garland as a great master, as a great actress, as a great singer, as a great dramatic singer. I don't think it's too strong to say that she detested her for her unreliability, for her egomania. Garland became a big part of Bergen's life when Bergen's husband began to manage her. And so Garland would call at 4 in the morning and, wow, and say she couldn't sleep, things like that. But what Bergen told me was that New York was the test, that everybody had counted Judy Garland out, thought she was out of the business, and everybody in the business was going to show up at Carnegie Hall. So it was all well and good for audiences in Dallas and Houston and Atlanta to go nuts, and they did, and the reviews were great. And by the way, it was the same program at every show, yeah, the same program at every show, but the audience at Carnegie Hall was going to consist, it was going to be full of stars, full of people in the business, everybody watching her keenly to see whether she really had come back.
Benny Goodman, Ethel Merman, yeah, Rock Hudson. Do you think people were there, I don't know,
morbid curiosity?
That's the term you use. I guess the question was, yeah, were they looking to see if she was going to fall on her face?
Yeah, or something else.
You bet.
That was the thing about Judy Garland. Yeah. You know, that was listen, Judy Garland, when you listen to Judy Garland, she is, for many people and for many people with refined musical tastes, with good ear, she is an acquired taste. She has the proverbial vibrato you could drive a truck through. She is not always on pitch. Her pitch wavers. Her range was mediocre at best, her musical range. But she was... I think arguably, along with Sinatra and Billie Holiday, one of the triumvirate of great interpreters, staggeringly great, colossal interpreters of the American popular song in the 20th century, and for the reason that she was an amazing actress. She was an amazing personality, and her life was drama. Everybody knew it. It was in all the papers. So that was transparent, and so the drama was present in every performance she did. And were people there to see whether she was gonna succeed or fall on her fanny? You bet they were. Mm. And when she began to succeed, and there were stutters throughout that evening, it wasn't seamless by any means. She never was. She was never seamless. There was an imperfection about everything she did. It was part of what endeared her to audiences.
Yeah. Yeah.
When it began to get better and better and good and good and then very good and then great and greater and greater, that evening just built and built and built. The audience knew that it was seeing something inimitable.
Mm. Describe the evening for us. It's April 23rd. It's warm, you say, kind of drizzly.
It's a Sunday night, warm, drizzly night, early spring, New York City, a very different New York City than the New York we know now. It was a time, of course, of no internet, no cell phones. And so when the New York Times printed a tiny little advertisement for this upcoming concert with a caricature of Judy Garland by Douglas Stone Martin, everybody in her huge and extremely passionate fan base zeroed in on this. You didn't need an internet in those days. And the lines started forming at the box office right away. So this concert was sold out. Huge anticipation, big crowds waiting outside Carnegie Hall. I was very fortunate to talk to a number of people who were there that night, and they brought the evening alive for me. Just this electric anticipation, waiting for Garland to show up, and then when her car did show up near Carnegie Hall, it sort of circled in. She's sitting in the back of this limo, wearing a hairnet, curlers, big giant sunglasses. One guy who was waiting there told me she looked like a bubblehead because she had this sort of blue net over her curlers. They all freaked out. They all began to run after the car as the car circled around in back of Carnegie Hall to the stage entrance. And when she got out of that car, it was very clear to all present that she was clean, she was sober, she was steady on her feet, she was confident, she was smiling, she was happy. She didn't limp or stagger into the stage entrance. She greeted one and all with great joy that this crowd had gathered, went in, and proceeded to get ready for the greatest concert of anybody's life.
It's great. You tell us the curtain time was scheduled for 8:30. And so 8:30 comes and then it goes and then Judy's in her dressing room and then 8:45 and no Judy yet. And then there's this question, you know, wait a minute, is she going to collapse? But
right.
that's not what was going on. She's milking the crowd, first of all, which
is
brilliant. But she's
crowd.
Also looking for a familiar face.
She was looking for a familiar face. I talked to Mike Nichols, who was on Broadway himself at that time with Nichols and May. He was in a box. He told me that he was not a huge Judy Garland fan. He just happened to be there with his friends, Mr. and Mrs. Richard Burton and a few other people in this box. Among the group in this box at the concert was the actor Roddy McDowall. And as you said, 8:30 came, it went, 8:45, 8:50, no Judy, no Judy, no Judy. Suddenly somebody sticks his head into the box that Mike Nichols and this group are sitting in and says, "She wants Roddy." So everybody assumed she's in an iron lung or something backstage. She is a basket case. She can't bear to face the world. She needs to talk to her dear friend Roddy McDowall to steady her on her feet. Well, it was nothing of the sort. She was, as you say, milking the crowd, milking the tension, milking the suspense. She was getting the crowd excited. She was a star, a superstar, and she wanted to talk to Roddy McDowall for a few minutes just to sort of center herself. She was not freaking out by any means. She just wanted to see a familiar face and chat for a couple of minutes.
Mm. Well, we're going to play some elements from that evening. Before we head to a break, though, James Kaplan, let me ask you, so Do we know what Judy was thinking? She had terrible stage fright throughout her life,
yes.
Although it didn't really come through. I didn't get a sense of that. So did she understand the stakes? Was that going through? Do we know what was going on in her mind?
I think that she did know. On the other hand, I think that she had a certain waiting in the wings ritual that I describe in the piece that I can't describe over the public airwaves.
It's great. It's great. Read the article. It's terrific.
Okay, so I'm reading from my own work, if you forgive me.
No, please.
This is Shayna Alexander, the late writer for Life magazine, who was following Judy Garland on her tour and was there that night. So Shayna Alexander says, Mort, meaning Mort Lindsay, the arranger and conductor for the evening, Mort had a wonderful overture which built up in tremendous excitement, Alexander recalled. You could hear the trolleys clanging and Over the Rainbow. And all these very familiar tunes. And it just built, and it got bigger and bigger. And by that time, Judy was standing backstage, and she would grab the curtain, and as the drums were going, she would yell at the audience, and she yelled what she yelled. I can't say it. Mm-hmm. But it's a very familiar expletive to everybody out there, referring to the audience. And this is not describing her disdain or dislike for the audience.
Yeah.
It was her way of, I think, achieving equilibrium. You know, she was terrified, and I would gently differ with you. I heard the fear in her voice. Mm-hmm. I hear the fear in her voice at that concert. She didn't disguise her nerves. She was nervous. You can hear the quaver that was always there. She fluffs some lines. She forgets some lyrics. But she, as she's chanting this chant, this obscene chant that she chant back to Shayna Alexander, and she seemed to sort of blow up like a balloon in a Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade. She would inflate, and then at the last explosion of the chords, she would just sail out onto the stage. It was like she was a pull toy. She was on a string, and she would glide out, and you would hear roars of applause.
James Kaplan is with us. His article, Over the Rainbow and Then Some, appears in the May issue of Vanity Fair. He's also the author of a new Frank Sinatra biography called Frank, The Voice. There are links to both on our website at KUER.org/Radio West. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about one extraordinary evening, one concert in 1961, Judy Garland at Carnegie Hall. What made the evening so memorable and remarkable went beyond the performance, which many have said really was amazing enough, but it was also the stakes for Judy Garland. James Kaplan, journalist, novelist, and biographer, is joining us. We're talking about the piece he's written in the latest Vanity Fair magazine about that evening. And he's joining us from the Radio Foundation in New York City. James Kaplan, so I wanted to just go to that first song because you talk about this moment. There's that thunderous applause, of course, in the overture, and she sails out and, okay, now she's on stage. But then the question is, all right, what's it going to sound like? Let me play that a bit of that first song, When You're Smiling, because as you talk about in the piece, once people heard it, I guess they figured, I think we're going to be okay. Is that about it?
Yes. And the thing that I left out before, and I know you want to play this, but I just want to very quickly say that it wasn't just that she got better and better throughout the evening, but maybe we can talk about it in a minute. This amazing conversation, communication, this intimacy between her and her audience that night got stronger and stronger throughout the night.
Here it is, that first song from her concert. Judy Garland, Carnegie Hall, 1961.
when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you. When you're laughing, the sun comes shining through. But when you're crying, you bring on the rain. So stop your sighing, be happy again. Keep on smiling when you're smiling.
James Kaplan, describe the show for us, if you would, because when you hear the song, you know, songs from the concert, it strikes you just how straightforward and simple it was. No grand fireworks, no gimmicks. It was really just her and a band.
Yeah, she had sort of soldiered her way through the bad years of the 1950s with a sort of dog and pony act that she took to Vegas for a number of years. She made a lot of money in Vegas. She spent more than she made. She was making in the mid 50s. She was making over $50,000 a week in Las Vegas, which in the mid 50s and even today is real money. But she was improvident, to say to put it mildly. But she had this kind of dog and pony show for her concert. She had a group of chorus boys at every concert. She would put on costumes, and one of her main props was this clown costume that she put on to sing her very sad songs. Underlining, in my opinion, that which did not need underlining. And clearly in her opinion later on, and in the opinion of her managers when she began this triumphant tour, she didn't need all that stuff. There's this great quote by Harold Arlen. All you need, I'm paraphrasing, but all you need is Judy Garland and a stage, and you have a show. And that's what they had.
Well, wasn't it on the program? Act one, Judy. Act two, more Judy. Basically.
That was it, plain and simple. Yeah. That was it, and that's really all you needed. She was an entire. Well, you know, it may be time now. Amazingly enough, there was no home movie footage, no footage taken that night at all. Some still photographs. That was it. Yeah. But on the 40th anniversary of the concert, the screenwriter and director Douglas McGrath wrote a tribute in the New York Times. And he said, among other things, that that concert is the all-time acting masterclass. It covers, he said, every single emotion. It teaches as much, he said, about the nuanced expression of emotion as those Stanislavski books. And it's 100 times the fun. And that was it. All you needed was Judy Garland and an orchestra and a stage and an audience.
I want to play an excerpt from the album, which I have to say I recommend. What's great about the album is that you, I'm sure they edited it some, but they preserved, thankfully, those interactions with the crowd. And there's this moment here, it's a little bit longer than 2 minutes, so maybe it's a little bit long, but what I love about it, James Kaplan, is the story she tells about being in Paris.
And
you can tell it's just this, she's interacting. As you said, you hear that quaver because she's a bit nervous, but you can see her trying to build the relationship. This is very early on in the concert. And you can see her kind of building that connection, I guess, that she has with the audience.
Yes.
Here it is.
I'm so excited. My goodness. I just got back. Well, not actually just got back. I got back about 3 months ago from Europe, and I did a tour on the continent, and I worked in Paris, and I'd never worked in Paris before. And I have a friend in Paris, a woman who is so chic. She's so chic that you can't stand it. She's a darling, marvelous woman. She's so chic. Anyway, she said, you must go to my hairdresser because obviously you need somebody. So she arranged She arranged for me to go to this marvelous Parisian fellow who is just supposed to be the end, you know. And he came in and took one look at me and was quite discouraged. And he said, "Now, the first thing we must do is you must look nothing like Judy Garland, nothing like yourself." No, and I said, "Well, don't you think I should look a little?" No, he said, "No, it'll be disastrous. We'll change you completely." So the night of the performance, he came back stage, and he had about 9 assistants, you know, and they clipped it. And my hair, it just got taller and taller. And really, it was about to here, you know. And in great big things out here, you know, spit curls, we used to call them in my day. I think they have new name for it now. And I looked very strange. I looked like an overweight Balenciaga model or something. And I came out for the concert that night. I walked out balancing my hair. When I work, I get very warm, as you can see. I really get so hot. And I started to sing, and I started to get warm. And my hair started to fall. And it got lower, and really, it was just, you know, Neanderthal. With all of the lacquer running down here, the spicker, it was terrible.
James Kaplan, I get that a lot of that concert was about her connection to the audience, I guess.
It was. It really. I'd love it. I'd love to read you just a couple of people I talked to very briefly. One man, a Garland, longtime Garland fan named Donald Smith, recalled there was a feeling in the hall of electricity, of the walls pumping. He said the audience were like holy rollers. It was like a revival meeting. One young man had done an oil painting of her, and as the cheers would break out at the end of a number, he would just hold it up in the air and shake it. And then another man, Andrew Velez, said the whole evening was this wonderful interplay back and forth between artist and audience that only happens every once in a while. Yeah. And when it does, there's nothing quite like it.
You know what else I think is really intriguing? I wanted to play a couple of examples of this. The thing that made her such a great performer, as you say, sometimes her pitch wasn't quite right. Maybe the vibrato was a little overdone, but it was about the thing that Polly Bergen told you. She described the way that Judy Garland would open herself up, that the sense that she would infuse her life experience into the song. And she said in some ways it was devastating to watch Judy Garland.
It was. It was. It took everybody, I think, to their own vulnerability. And I think that part of the triumph of the show was seeing her triumph over her intense and storied vulnerability.
I want to play. I have to say, I think for me, I guess everyone who listens to it probably has their own kind of moment. I know you do, and we're going to play some of that in a moment here. But I want to talk to you or ask you about and play this excerpt from Do It Again, because it seems to underline something that, again, Polly Bergen told you. She talks about these silences in the concert. Now, we're talking about Carnegie Hall. She says, you know, you've got this massive concert hall, it's almost impossible to find moments of silence. But she said throughout that concert, you heard them all the time. And I heard them in Do It Again. Say something about that, because I want to play just an excerpt from this piece as well.
Well, the audience was listening raptly to her. They were ready to explode at the end of every song, but they wanted to hear every single note. And this is a particularly spare arrangement of the great Gershwin, George Gershwin, Buddy De Silva number, which is a very, by the way, it's not Ira Gershwin writing that lyric, it's Buddy De Silva. It's a very erotic song, and the audience is hanging on every syllable.
You really shouldn't have done it. You hadn't any right. I really shouldn't have let you kiss me. And although it was wrong, I never was strong. So as long as you've begun it, and you know You shouldn't have done it. Oh, do it again. I may cry. Just ache to have you take the kiss that's waiting for you. You know if you do, you
James Kaplan, one of the things you point out in the piece is one element of the way she performed was with a restraint, something that you don't sometimes hear these days. She knew when to not give everything to a song, if that makes sense.
Yes, she was a great interpreter, and she knew. She makes a joke at one point in the concert about the songs that she's known for, very very tragic, sad songs and holiday songs, marches.
Right.
She said, and then she joked and laughed, and she said, "Well, sometimes I'd like to sing in the middle." In truth, she was a great actress, as we know, and a great singer with an artist's sense of modulation. She knew when to belt. She knew when to dial it way down. She knew when to do it quietly, and she knew when to make it much louder. She knew how to rouse an audience, but knew how to make them. She knew how to make a pin drop.
Mm. Talk about the piece, "The Man That Got Away." This is one that you've said sort of reveals something about the way Judy Garland performs.
Well, it's simply one of the great songs of the American Songbook. It is it's Harold Arlen and the aforementioned Ira Gershwin. My feeling about the song has always been that it's Ira Gershwin writing very autobiographically about his brother, George, who died tragically young, 39 years old in 1937. But Judy Garland had a famously checkered and difficult and dramatic love life. Many, many men. She was at MGM in the 1930s and 40s when that place was crawling with gorgeous women. Lana Turner, Ava Gardner, and she always felt like a sort of ugly little dumpling. And yet she was drawn very strongly to men. Her love life was could be tragic, and so the man that got away, not the man who got away, the man that got away, was very deep in her, very autobiographical, and we hear it. We hear it when she sings it, that this song was written deeply autobiographically by Ira Gershwin and sung definitively autobiographically by Judy Garland.
The night is bitter, the stars have lost their glitter, the winds grow colder, suddenly you're older, and all because of the man that got away. that won you has run off and undone you. That great beginning has seen a final inning. Don't know what happened. It's all a crazy game. Don't run that old time through, for you've been through the mill. Good riddance. Goodbye.
James Kaplan is with us. He's the author of Frank, The Voice. His article, Over the Rainbow and Then Some, appears in the May issue of Vanity Fair. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio.
But fools will be fools.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Judy Garland and one performance 50 years ago, almost exactly 50 years ago today. We're joined by the journalist and novelist and biographer James Kaplan, whose account of Garland's 1961 Carnegie Hall concert appears in May's Vanity Fair. He's joining us today from New York City, James Kaplan is. And James Kaplan, what's even more remarkable than the fact that the concert was recorded so that we can hear that moment, play some of those songs, was the fact that it almost wasn't. I mean, Garland's record label wasn't really sure if it wanted to record the evening.
Alan Livingston, the head of Capitol Records, was a huge fan of Garland, had signed her up with great hopes in the early 1950s, and initially her records sold, but then they stopped selling. And as she became, as her train wreck status continued to evince itself, she was unreliable about showing up for recording dates, and the records weren't selling anyway. She became a bit of a write-off for Capitol Records. His widow, Alan Livingston's widow, tells me that he was persuaded, I think, by Garland's management to record this concert. He also felt that recording her live, as opposed to getting her into a studio reliably, was the only way that he could record her. Little did he know that he was, in recording her for Capitol that night, creating a record that would never go out of print, that would be number one for many, many weeks, that would win Grammys all over the place, that has never been out of print.
So describe, if you would, as you say, it builds and builds and builds the evening. Describe those feelings at the end, because I want to talk about some of the moments there. It goes without saying that the crowd went wild, I guess, as the end of the show approached. Let me play a moment here, because I want you to talk about what happens, because things change kind of here at the end, which is really interesting. This is just out of the song Rock-a-Bye My Baby.
Rock-a-bye, you're rock-a-bye.
Okay, so there's this big applause. The crowd couldn't really contain themselves. You say that many of those, and this is what's another interesting element about that, is that the one of the core sort of key component to the audience was gay men. She was a critical part of the gay community, kind of a gay icon,
yes,
as a lot of people know that. But they kind of crashed the stage, came right up front.
Yes. There was a point that the band kept trying to play her off.
Right.
they kept on playing her off with this instrumental of Over the Rainbow. And it was understood that she would come out and do an encore. She would sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow, her signature song, Over the Rainbow, I should say. And so that was understood. But the band kept trying to play her off and with this instrumental. And the crowd started calling out song titles to her, and she only had so many arrangements for so many songs. And Judy Garland calls back to the crowd. She says, "I know, I'll sing them all, and we'll stay all night." And at that point, as I say in the piece, the dam burst. The gay men who were there that night, and they were a key component of her audience, but I do want to emphasize as well, in fairness all around, not the only, not
sure,
the majority
sure.
component of her audience. I think her, just as a slight aside, that the association of Judy Garland with this passion for her and her life and her music among gay men is something that built throughout her career and certainly posthumously and has a lot to do with her early death in 1969. At that point, it was very powerful, but the audience was also it was a mixed audience. There were a lot of back in the upper rows, even I'm told, plumbers and hairdressers and carpenters and their families from Queens. So and Brooklyn. So, but the group of gay men who were there, according at least by the testimony of a couple of the men I spoke to for the piece, at that point when she said, "I will stay all night," couldn't control themselves, and suddenly everybody is running down from upstairs because I think a lot of the non-famous people were in the balcony, running down from upstairs and up to the foot of the stage, gathering, crowding the foot of the stage, calling out, standing up, to the point where Judy Garland had to request very nicely for them all to sit down. There was a carpet on the floor at the foot of the stage, and everybody very obediently sat down as she proceeded to do a couple more encores.
I know. I'll sing them all, and we'll stay all night.
James Kaplan, so what happened? Well, I guess what's the aftermath? The grand plan seemed to be working, seemed to be on track. But I guess in some ways, it wasn't to last. It did bring her back on track in some ways, but it wasn't exactly.
No, it was not to last.
Yeah.
It was the culmination. It was the acme. It was the zenith. It was her highest moment. The tour continued. She did a few more cities after Carnegie Hall. It went on. She had a successful next year. She acted in Judgment at Nuremberg and was nominated for an Oscar for her role in that movie. She signed a long-term TV contract with CBS for a weekly variety show that went okay for a while until, unfortunately, the head of CBS, a man named James Aubrey, took such an intense dislike to Judy Garland that he pulled the plug on it. Her career sort of fluttered and wavered and staggered a bit after that, and then unfortunately, predictably, the substances that she had managed to avoid for a while re-entered the scene, and as did more bad luck with the fellas, and she went downhill. Unfortunately, died tragically, I should say, not unfortunately, died of a overdose in 1969.
Do you ever? Maybe there's no point in thinking about this, but do you ever wonder what would have happened if the concert, you know, hadn't worked, if she hadn't risen to the occasion? Do you ever wonder about that? What if, as you're thinking about this evening?
You know. I really haven't. I think that she was such. I think about it in terms of inevitability.
Yeah.
She was such a great star, and so and by the way, she certainly had her non-fans,
sure.
People who disliked her. She had an enormous number of people who loved her and spoke of her not in terms of tragedy, because it's so easy to speak of her in terms of tragedy and her difficult life, but really preferred to talk about how funny she was, how incredibly intelligent, how great she was to be with. And so I think that at a moment when she saw that she had risen from her hospital bed, that she could muster the resources to do this tour with a true showwoman's sense of timing and importance and scale and theater, I think her tremendous will, along with her tremendous artistic sensibility, made this evening a success. Yes, the audience was half of it, but I think that she began it, and so I do think of it in terms of inevitability.
Let me ask you this finally, about a minute left, because I wanted to end with that song that has become, of course, her signature. You say, James Kaplan, that Over the Rainbow was not her dwelling in the past. It was a yearning for the future.
She always yearned for the future, and don't we all? Judy Garland was like us all, only more so. She felt that things would get better, and she tried awfully hard. She didn't try to make her life a tragedy. She didn't try to be addicted to substances. This was something that happened to her. A lot of things happened to her, but her hope was something that we all identified with and continue to identify with very powerfully. Do we have 15 seconds? I'd love to read you
Please.
A very quick thing. Michael Feinstein, I interviewed for this piece, and he wrote me a wonderful thing in an email because that show means a lot to him. He said that 1961 show was about Judy Garland's love for the songs, the songwriters, the orchestrators, for the gift of heightened communication it gave to her and the audience. It was her lifeline to survival and sanity and sanctity. It was the culmination of her life experience. That can be felt from the first notes she sings, and the recording survives as a testament to how art can change our lives.
James Kaplan, author of Frank, The Voice, his article Over the Rainbow and Then Some appears in the May issue of Vanity Fair. James Kaplan, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you so much, Doug. I loved it.
Way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby. Somewhere skies are blue, and the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true. Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me. Where troubles melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops. That's where bluebirds fly.
happy little bluebirds fly beyond the rainbow.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson, the program produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.